Democracy consists of choosing your dictators after they've told you what you think it is you want to hear. British broadcaster Alan Coren.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott. That was Uncle Ian. Today's podcast features two incredible Southeast Asian dictators, Suharto and Ferdinand Marcos. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single biggest dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Up first, Ferdinand Marcos was president of the Philippines from 1965 to 1986. He's one of the most controversial leaders of the 20th century. Uncle Ian, tell us about Marcos. How did this man come to power?
Ferdinand Edralin Marcos, born on the 11th of September 1917 in Surat on the island of Luzon. We remember him as a lawyer and politician. He was the son of teachers, although his real father may have been a wealthy judge of Chinese background. He attended school in Manila. He first comes to notice in 1935 when he shot and killed a political opponent of his father. He was found guilty in 1939, subsequently was acquitted in the Supreme Court, possibly due to the influence of the wealthy judge of Chinese background. He went on to study law at the University of Philippines in order to become a trial lawyer. In 1942, the Philippines were invaded by the Japanese as they made their way through Southeast Asia. In 1943, Marcos was part of a movement called Ang Ma Mahalika. It was a resistance organization supposedly working against the Japanese. However, it was made up of forgers and pickpockets, gunmen and gangsters. It appears to have been more of a commercial operation than an actual guerrilla movement. And Marcos made himself out to be a guerrilla fighter against the Japanese. After the war, the Philippines became independent. And just to give you a little bit of an idea of the type of country, the Philippines is made up of some 7,000 islands. At last count, there are 87 different languages. Now, the Philippines had been a Spanish colony, going all the way back to Magellan landing there in the 1520s.
The name, the Philippines, comes from King Philip of Spain.
It had become a US colony in 1898 and had obtained autonomy in the mid-1930s, so was then able to become an independent republic after the Second World War. After the war, Marcos became a technical assistant to Manuel Rojas, who was the first president of the Independent Republic. He was interested in a career in politics in his own right, and in 1949 was elected a member of the House of Representatives. He graduated in 1959 to the Philippine Senate, and by 1963 he was serving as president of the Senate. The next Philippines election for president was due in 1965. Up until that point, each Philippines president had only served a single term. However, in 1965, Macapagal, the Liberal Party president, wanted to stand again. Marcos expected to obtain the Liberal Party endorsement, was unsuccessful, so he switched parties. He moved to the Nationalist Party and defeated the president in the 1965 election campaign. Each side is recorded as having spent, and this is 1965 values, approximately $8 million on their campaign. An extraordinary amount of money in a developing country. Marcos was inaugurated as president on the 30th of December 1965. He would be re-elected in 1969, the first Philippines president to serve as a second term. Some of the elements of Marcos's first term included great progress in agriculture. There was a marked increase in rice production to support the growing population, There was progress in industry and construction projects, and also widespread reforms in education to make literacy programs more available throughout the Philippines. And Marcos went back on one of his earlier pledges. When he was a member of the Liberal Party, he was a strong opponent of sending troops to Vietnam. Once he became president, he decided that the Philippines would send troops to fight on the side of the South in the Second Vietnamese War. By doing so, he increased his anti-communist stance, and that attracted the attention of the United States. During the early 70s, the authoritarian measures which Marcos was undertaking started to attract resistance. There were increased student demonstrations, and in the various jungles, guerrilla activities which were causing great inconvenience to the regime. Marcos realized also in 1973 that the presidency would be subject to another election. He wanted to avoid having to go for re-election. So he engineered a scheme whereby he would be able to launch martial law. The trigger for martial law was an attack on Defense Minister Enrile. Subsequently, Enrile admitted that that attack was in fact faked. But Marcos was able to use that as the trigger for martial law, claiming that communist and subversive forces were a threat to the security of the Philippines. He started putting opposition politicians in jail, most notably Benigno Aquino. The main threats, according to Marcos, came from the Maoist communist New People's Army and in the south of the country, Muslim separatists such as the Moro National Liberation Front, who were undertaking guerrilla activities in the provinces.
The crackdown on the communists and the Muslims was quite brutal. Very brutal, in fact. Amnesty International reported that 70,000 Filipinos were imprisoned, 34,000 people were tortured, and at least 3,200 people were documented to have been killed. As for the torture, there was a lot of the common forms we've already seen in this podcast, the beatings, the drownings, the electrocution, but it gets worse than that. I have an account from a woman from the island of Samar. She recounts the story of the murder of her husband. I'll quote, "They burned our house down, and then they roasted my husband like a pig, just like a pig, turning round and round on a stake. They tied his hands and feet around the stake. The charcoal they used was from our burnt wooden house. They picked off his flesh and ate it. They finished eating him, only the skeleton was left."
Martial law gave him the opportunity to re-establish himself in power. He called a referendum in 1973, and that confirmed him in power for life. During this time, the armed forces increased in size, in fact, tripled in size during the time of martial law, up to a membership of 200,000 members, which meant that he was able to retain control across all of the islands throughout the Philippines. So in January of 1981, Marcos made the announcement that he was going to bring martial law to an end. It seems a nice gesture, but it turned out that the Pope was due, so he wanted to make it appear that he was a benevolent ruler before the Pope arrived. Now, if you haven't heard of Ferdinand Marcos, there's a very good chance you've heard of his wife, Imelda. They married in 1954. Usually when people say Imelda Marcos, then in brackets after that, it says former beauty queen. She was more than that, though, and became a key member of the regime. So, for example, without much political background, in 1975, she became governor of Metropolitan Manila, and in 1979, added the role of Minister of Human Settlements and Ecology. And she served in both of those roles up until the end of the Marcos regime in 1986. Now, while the pay for those roles was lucrative in itself, it also gave opportunities for the granting of favours to family and friends.
The Marcos family is alleged to have embezzled up to $10 billion Imelda Marcos became famous for her ostentatious extravagance. Imelda herself is quoted as saying, "I get my fingers in all our pies. Before you know it, your little fingers, including all your toes, are in all the pies." $10 billion in a quite a poor country is just incredible. During the eventual downfall of the regime, they went through all her cupboards and they found 3,000 pairs of shoes. She has contested that figure. It said there was only 1,070.
As if that makes it right.
Oh, the concept of the 3,000 shoes has made her famous. For example, Bono once said, "I am the Imelda Marcos of sunglasses." I think that would make me the Imelda Marcos of linen shirts. Uncle Ian, what are you the Imelda Marcos of?
I would probably be the Imelda Marcos of tea infusers.
On the shoes, she said, "They went into my closets looking for skeletons, but thank God, all they found were shoes. Beautiful shoes." I'm just going to keep reading Imelda Marcos quotes because she's fantastic. "If you know how rich you are, then you are not rich. But me, I'm not aware of the extent of my wealth. That's how rich we are. Win or lose, we go shopping after the election." You know, not even your British queen is called just Elizabeth. She's Elizabeth II. There's only one Imelda. "I hate ugliness. You know I'm allergic to ugliness. It is not expensive to be beautiful. It only takes a little effort to be presentable and beautiful. But it takes some effort. And unfortunately, people think of beauty as a luxury, beauty as frivolity or extravagance. Beauty is a discipline. Beauty is an art. Beauty is harmony in the ideological sense and in the theological sense. Beauty is God and love made real. And the ultimate reach in this world is beauty."
It's a wonderful legacy she's left to her country.
Her most famous scandal was the cheese scandal. They were coming back from Rome, nearly home, told the pilot to turn around because she forgot to buy cheese. During the 1974 Miss Universe pageant, which was being hosted in the Philippines.
Was that hosted by Donald Trump or was that before he got involved in beauty pageants?
I'm not sure if Trump was there, but Imelda was there, and that's all that matters, according to Imelda. And she asked her husband to order the Philippine Air Force to seed the clouds to prevent a typhoon forming so that they would have better weather during the beauty pageant. She even dispatched a plane to collect white sand from Australia for a beach resort opening. And she was just a pest. She would invite herself various places. For example, she invited herself to Nixon's inauguration, rocked up uninvited, as well as to the Sydney Opera House dedication. She just turned up. Fidel Castro loved her. The late Cuban leader once said that he only drove for two women, his mother and Imelda Marcos.
So, 1981, big year in the Philippines. Martial law was repealed in January and Marcos had promised to have fresh elections. In June of 1981, Marcos was re-elected president. It wasn't quite a 99.8% majority, but it was a long way up there. He was re-elected for a five-year term, by which time he's well into his 60s. The rampant government corruption, the embezzlement, the increase in economic inequality between the rich and poor, continued human rights violations, suppression of the media, and a phrase we haven't yet met, Scott, a phrase called crony capitalism, the seizing of private businesses and then them being handed over to family and friends to run, was a hallmark of his regime. 1983, Marcos's health started to fail, and Benigno Aquino, who'd been in exile for a number of years, decided to return to Manila, hoping to meet with Marcos and to try and organise a peaceful transition of power. When Aquino got off the plane at Manila Airport, he was shot. The assassination reverberated around the world, and it was subsequently found out that it had been organised by senior military officers. Marcos himself was able to distance himself from the assassination by ordering an independent investigation. I suspect he ordered that investigation to find that he wasn't responsible for it, but the fact that senior military officers were responsible, trying to curry favour with Marcos, meant that his regime was thrown into very sharp focus. A rising opposition movement led by Aquino's widow Corazon gained increasing level of support throughout the Philippines. Marcos called a snap election.
The revealing of his fake war record when the truth came out before the final election really hurt his chances. He claimed to be the most decorated soldier in the Philippines with 27 medals that we now know to be fake. And we know dictators love their medals because he gained office on the back of his war heroism. Part of the reason he was caught was that the 27 battles he received medals for, he would have had to be in two places at once. A US Army captain who was stationed in the Philippines during the Second World War said that the unit Marcos supposedly led into these 27 battles never existed.
The 7th of February 1986, a snap election. The following week, he announced that he had been victorious in the presidential election. No one believed him, and the evidence of electoral fraud was very widespread. There were riots in the streets, and it was obvious that a civil war was going to break out. I should also mention one other person who was in play at the time of the revolution, remembering that the Philippines, having been Spanish for so long, a strongly Catholic country. During the riots in February, one of the stabilizing factors was the Archbishop. His name was Cardinal Sin.
That is superb.
He enjoyed making references to his name, Cardinal Jamie Sin, and in fact, he referred to the place where he lived as the House of Sin. Apart from jokes on his name, he was a stabilizing factor during the People Power Revolution. He, in fact, strongly encouraged the armed forces to make sure that politicians who were supporting Corazon Aquino were protected from the armed forces by being endorsed by Cardinal Sin. That role that he played, not just helping Aquino come to power, but preserving peace. Marcos contacted his friends in the United States asking for help. The United States decided to help. They sent a plane. And Reagan said to Marcos, "You better get on it." 25th of February 1986, that plane took off to Hawaii. On that plane was $15 million US dollars in cash. That was only a small amount of the estimated minimum $10 billion US that they'd amassed.
A lot of the loot was left behind. The 1,060 pairs of shoes have now been placed in a museum in the shoe manufacturing region of the Philippines. The amount of wealth and luxury items that were found was just extraordinary. For example, a Cartier tiara with a rare 25-carat pink diamond was found, a Bagari bracelet, a $1 million price tag. She once shopped for a $3.5 million Michelangelo painting in Rome.
Marcos stayed in exile in Honolulu until 1989, at which time his health finally failed. Imelda was allowed to return to the Philippines in 1991. In 1993, she was found guilty of corruption. That verdict was overturned in 1998. Even in the late 80s, while Marcos was in exile in Honolulu, the Filipino people did not believe he was ill. They purely believed that the stories of his illness were designed to justify him not appearing in court to face the crimes for which he'd been indicted. Marcos's reputation continues to be invoked by Filipino politicians who believe that they can use his lengthy time in power to their advantage, especially when they want to play the anti-communist card. And quite dramatically, in 2016, Duterte ordered that Marcos be moved so that he could be buried with full honours at the National Heroes Cemetery in Manila.
Law and order and peace resulted from the regime, but at what cost? The government really had a monopoly on violence. The crime rate was low, but only if you discount the crimes of the regime.
Unfortunately, it did show what could be achieved in the Philippines by someone without any morals who was able to get international backing because of their A, anti-communist stance, but B, because they were able to bring a level of stability to the country. The subsequent history, it's fair to say, has not been stable, and I think a lot of that traces back to the different movements that formed during the Marcos regime.
There is a theory that the Marcos regime saved lives by preventing a Vietnam War style complete civil war, and that the martial law was necessary.
I think it's fair to say that the circumstances in which martial law became necessary in 1972, a lot of that had been engineered by Marcos himself, trying to bring power to himself. So it's a bit of the self-fulfilling prophecy. The supposed kidnapping attempt on En Relay, which was the trigger for martial law, to me, it's just got echoes of the burning of the Reichstag.
And the murder of Kirov?
Yes, and some of the tricks that Stalin used to pull in order to bring more power to himself as well.
Part of the reason he's remembered fondly is because of the nostalgia of the time. When Marcos came to power, the Philippines was the second largest economy in Asia. But that's partly due to the fact that China wasn't doing anything. They were still a closed communist country, and then they opened up and just took all the manufacturing away from the Philippines. And that has nothing to do with Marcos. It's just the fact that China's taken over. And you can remember Marcos era fondly, but that has nothing to do with Marcos.
The Washington Post wrote after Marcos's death, and I quote, "By the end of his rule, it was clear that Marcos had lied about everything, from his health to his personal fortune, from his World War II record to his golf game. He worked on behalf of Filipino politicians during the war who collaborated with the Japanese."
Time to move on to our next dictator, this time in Indonesia. Suharto was president of Indonesia from 1967 to 1998 and became notorious for controlling state enterprises, siphoning money from state charities alongside mass bloodshed and violations of human rights. Suharto was born on the 8th of June 1921 in a village on the Indonesian island of Java. You're probably wondering why I haven't told you his full name. Suharto only has one name, like Madonna or Cher or Scott and Uncle Ian. It's very common on the island of Java to have just one name. So Indonesia is a Southeast Asian country above Australia and below Malaysia and Vietnam. It contains 200 million people of 300 ethnic groups, speaking 250 languages, inhabiting about 6,000 islands, all spread over a 5,000-kilometre archipelago. Uncle Ian, what united these vast and disparate islands?
The main element of unity in Indonesia was their willingness not to be colonised. They'd been a Dutch colony right back to the 16th century, which is, of course, one of the reasons why it was Dutch sailors were the first Europeans to land in Australia, because some of them took a few wrong turns on their way to Jakarta, or Batavia as they knew it.
Suharto grew up very poor, so poor that he once had to change schools because he could not afford the shorts and shoes that were required uniform. He continued to have clothing issues as he got older. He resigned from his job after he tore his only set of work clothes in a bicycle accident. Suharto joined the Royal Netherlands Indies Army, which I assume supplied him his own set of clothes. Indonesia was invaded by Japan, and midway through World War II, they surrendered to Japan. So Suharto then joined the Japanese Volunteer Army, reaching the rank of commander. After the Japanese were defeated by the Allies in 1945, Suharto joined the Indonesian Independence Force. So he's fought for the Dutch and then for the Japanese, and now he's fighting for Indonesian independence.
After the Second World War, it was an opportunity for the Indonesians to gain their independence from the Dutch, and they worked for that in the years after the Japanese defeat.
In 1949, Indonesia officially gained independence from the Dutch. Suharto rose within the army, and President Sukarno made Suharto a major general in 1962. This President Sukarno declared himself president for life the following year. Sukarno also only has one name. He was a lefty and he was the first Indonesian president following independence. The names are similar, so don't get Sukarno confused with Suharto, who is our protagonist. 1965, everything changes. In 1965, Indonesia contained the largest Communist Party membership of any non-communist country. The Communist Party was called the PKI. Communist military personnel formed a group called the 30th of September Movement, and in 1965, they attempted a coup killing military officials. Confusingly, it took place on the 1st of October, a day late. The communists killed 6 of the 7 Indonesian generals. Suharto survived the execution during the uprising because he was visiting his young son in hospital. The coup failed and General Suharto assumed control of the military and with it the entire country. President Sukarno remained president, but General Suharto had the real power. Suharto purged the government of Sukarno supporters, eventually forcing President Sukarno to step down in 1967. He was placed under house arrest and later died. It was in 1968 Suharto officially became president of Indonesia, replacing the left-wing President Sukarno, who was seen as guilty by his association with the communists. Some suspect that the failed coup was faked, that it wasn't orchestrated by communists, and Suharto didn't simply get lucky and avoid assassination. There's good evidence that contradicts that theory. It's more likely that Suharto and others had pre-planned much of their takeover of Indonesia and were ready when the communist coup attempt gave them the grounds needed to act. So it was a mix of spontaneity and pre-planning. Suharto, the new president of Indonesia, presented himself to the people as a man of humble origins, shy and retiring. He spoke gently and smiled to friends and foes. He became known as the Smiling General. Despite being Muslim, he followed Indonesian traditions of mysticism and superstition. The president of the world's fourth most populous country consulted gurus, shamans, spiritual advisors, and soothsayers. Uncle Ian, out of the gurus, shamans, spiritual advisors, and soothsayers, who do you think is offering the best advice?
I would go back to my Shakespeare and say you'd always look towards a soothsayer.
What does a soothsayer do?
I think we're all just looking at fortune tellers by another name.
Following his takeover were the purges. The failed communist coup, along with anti-communist propaganda, triggered infamous massacres in 1965 and 1966. The military took part in the killings in some areas, but the massacres were mostly carried out by civilian militia groups with the approval and direction of the military. Killings in an area would begin when Suharto's special force arrived with his trusted colonel, Sawo Edhi. The colonel is quoted as saying, "We gave them 2 or 3 days training, then sent them out to kill the communists." Yes, the army recruited, armed, and trained militia units, mostly recruited from ANSOR, Indonesia's largest Islamic organization. There were deep resentments between the anti-religious communists and the conservative Muslims. The military sent to religious groups fabricated PKI documents with hit lists of Islamic figures the communists planned to kill. These were all faked. This created the perception that it was kill or be killed. This fear-mongering of certain groups is very common in dictatorships. First, they say everything wrong in your life is a result of Group X. Then they dehumanize Group X. Then they say Group X are coming to get us, so we need to get them first. Whether it's the Jews or the Armenians or the rich or the educated, it's the same pattern. On the majoritively Hindu island of Bali, the justification for the massacres differed from the Muslim regions. The communist desire to abolish rigid hierarchies clashed with the Hindu caste system and angered the religious leaders. So with the inclusion of the Hindu caste system, we now have all the stupid ideologies in one place. Approximately 80,000 people were killed in Bali. Uncle Ian, have you been to Bali? I think we're the only two people in Australia who haven't been. The risk of Bali barely makes it less appealing. I've always been reluctant to go on a holiday in a place that you're almost guaranteed to get violent diarrhea.
Given that one of the major attractions of Bali is its surfing culture, I'm not known as a surfer.
No, you're not. 80,000 people have been massacred in Bali not too long ago. How have they managed to curate this image of a beachy island paradise?
I think some of that does come back to the Hindu culture. It's a very forgiving culture, and it's a culture that is very welcoming.
Meanwhile, the beaches of Rwanda and Bosnia remain unvisited. In terms of the massacres, along with the presumed communists, their entire families were wiped out. PKI members were arrested in their homes, tortured, and then taken to the forest to be killed via dismembering, stabbing, disembowelment, castration, impaling, strangulation, and beheading. The use of firearms was uncommon. Bodies were dumped in mass graves, in caves, rivers, or left on the street mutilated for public display. I'll quote a famous Indonesian author, Pipit Rochijat, from his book, Am I PKI or Non-PKI? Quote, it would happen like this. A particular village would be surrounded by squads of nationalist and religious youth. On average, 3,000 people would be involved. The expectation was that, with the village surrounded, no communist elements would be able to escape. It was pretty effective too. Each day, as we went to or returned from State Senior High School, he always saw corpses of communists floating in the River Brantas, and usually the corpses were no longer recognizable as human, headless, stomachs torn open. The smell was unbelievable. To make sure they didn't sink, the carcasses were deliberately tied to, or impaled on, bamboo stakes. The departure of the corpses from the region down the Brantas River achieved its golden age when the bodies were stacked together on rafts over which the PKI banner flew. The exportation of corpses down the Brantas River began to bother the downstream city of Surabaya. The rumour went round that the drinking water was filtered out of the river, and by the time they reached Surabaya, the corpses were in complete decay. After protests from the city, PKI bodies were no longer flung into the Brantas River, but were disposed of in mass graves. The prepared holes were dug big, and thus were capable of handling dozens of communists at a time. Furthermore, at one time the road leading up to Mount Klotok was decorated with PKI heads. Hanging up in front of the houses were rows of communist penises, like bananas, hung out for sale. Naturally, such mass killings were welcomed by the nationalist and religious groups. They felt the target of taking 100,000 communist lives for each general had to be achieved. Uncle Ian, they might have achieved that figure. Estimates of the number of dead range from 500,000 to 1 million dead. In addition to those that were killed, 750,000 people were imprisoned for as long as 30 years. Women affiliated with the PKI were commonly raped in prison. Following the massacres, children's textbooks were quickly distributed, detailing the horror of the communist murders of the generals in the failed coup. Suharto's subsequent massacre of a million suspected communists was left out. A propaganda film reenacting the killing of the generals was screened repeatedly on all TV stations. Each year, October 1st was commemorated. The narrative was, Indonesia survived the communist attempted coup and the dead generals were celebrated as martyrs. For the 32 years Suharto was in power, the Indonesian media faithfully promoted this narrative while ignoring the subsequent massacres. For decades, victims were afraid to speak on the subject for fear of being labelled a communist. So the initial killing that rocked a nation was repeated, sensationalised and promulgated. But the 6 months of chaos and violence that followed was completely brushed aside. So how did Suharto manage all this? It's important to bring up the backing that he received from the Americans. They were fighting the Cold War, and their domino theory predicted that once China and Vietnam fell to communism, Indonesia would be next. So Suharto was avowedly anti-communist, so the Americans sent Suharto $4 billion a year. The incredible irony, of course, was that Suharto, while an anti-communist, engaged in much of what we despised in communism. One-party rule, arrest and murder of dissidents, expansionism, state control of businesses, and widespread corruption and embezzlement. He wasn't a very good anti-communist. To be fair on the Americans, I will point out they also offered money to the previous left-wing president, but he told them to, quote, go to hell. Time magazine reported Suharto's emergence as the West's best news in years, and American officials received updates on the executions, and a US embassy staff member gave a list of communists to the Indonesian military. The American involvement in Indonesia was not new. Back in 1958, the CIA armed rebellions against the Indonesian government. The CIA even recorded a sex tape starring a man wearing a President Sukarno mask with the hope of disgracing him. Uncle Lee, when are we going to release your sex tape?
I think we might save that for one of the retrospective episodes.
If you're not willing, then I'll just get someone in an Uncle Ian mask.
So just someone with a moustache?
Yes, exactly.
Does Kanye have a moustache?
No, no moustache. Sad news, he's divorcing from his wife.
That's an interesting way to react to not becoming president.
I think it was her way of reacting to him not becoming president. The Americans were everywhere during this period, and I'm reluctant to bring them into it. I don't want to pretend that the Indonesians have no agency and everything is the Americans' fault rather than the actual murderers piling up corpses in the river.
So Australia looked at the Indonesian regime, certainly with a great deal of interest. You mentioned the domino theory, and after the Second World War, China, North Korea, Vietnam had become communist. And Suharto was certainly conscious of his opportunities in foreign policy. Under Suharto, Indonesia rejoined the United Nations. The Australian view of the Suharto regime is summed up by Don Watson in the book Recollections of a Bleeding Heart about his time in Paul Keating's office. And I quote, "Under Suharto, Indonesia's economy grew, modernised and integrated with the region and the world. As it did so, it developed what trade officials like to call complementarities with the Australian economy, meaning it created trade and investment opportunities. The Indonesian standard of living rose markedly, literacy rates dramatically improved, Indonesian society was remarkably stable, and, examples of brutal repression notwithstanding, Indonesia's polyglot religions and cultures enjoyed a substantial measure of tolerance." Watson then goes on to say that while Suharto certainly engaged in repression, that the alternative to a Suharto regime would have been substantial and lengthy disorder on Australia's doorstep. Trying to look at the Suharto regime in a balanced manner is very difficult, but Suharto was very conscious of the importance of maintaining a foreign image.
It's these achievements that enabled him to stay in power for the 32 years. The so-called New Order he introduced with the help of American-trained economists. You mentioned the economic growth, 7% per year. The inflation rate when he got in was 630%. He got that down to under 9%. And Indonesia moved from being the world's largest rice importer to being a rice exporter. And with all this extra money, he managed to embezzle even more of it. We heard about the embezzlement in the Philippines. Have a listen to this. Suharto's wife, Madam Tien, handled the family's business affairs. Her detractors called her Madam Tien Percent, a reference to the cut she received on shady business deals. That is my favourite nickname of all time. That's fantastic. Might be better than Gucci Grace.
I think Imelda's probably jealous of Ibu Tien Percent.
The Suharto family acquired monopolies in paper, cement, plywood, cloves, power plants, automobiles, and banks. One daughter owned all the tolls on the highways. His son became chairman of a conglomerate of 90 companies. Another son was connected to the state oil monopoly. Whatever favors were not given to the Suharto family went to friends. One Indonesian scholar was quoted as saying, "At least 80% of major government projects go in some form to the president's children or friends." The Suharto raked in $35 billion from their dodgy business interests. This is a country with a GDP of $100 per person. Suharto came first in Transparency International's global corruption rankings. Coming in second was Ferdinand Marcos. Sorry, mate. Uncle Ian, I mentioned earlier that the regime was expansionist. Can you please tell us about East Timor?
East Timor was a relic of the Portuguese Empire. It had remained in Portuguese hands right through until the 1970s. The western part of Timor had been part of the Netherlands East Indies, so became part of Indonesia when Indonesia became a republic. But the Portuguese colony remained so until 1974. At that time, there was a coup in Lisbon, and the new regime did not want anything to do with Portugal's overseas colonies and left them adrift.
So the coup in Portugal had meant that East Timor was without its Portuguese colonists.
Suharto's ears pricked up when he heard the news. He started formulating plans for incorporating East Timor into Indonesia. bearing in mind that East Timor, having been a Portuguese colony, was Catholic and had totally different cultural and linguistic background. But Suharto had a base in West Timor from which he could invade East Timor. And they did so in October 1975.
Embarrassingly, the Australian government, prior to the invasion, encouraged the annexation of East Timor. It was considered Indonesia's 27th province. The government believed it would bring stability after the departure of the Portuguese. The invasion of East Timor was especially brutal. The population of 700,000, that sharply fell by 200,000.
That's in addition, Scott, to all of the people who were forcibly moved across into West Timor.
As well as East Timor, there were dramas in West Papua.
West Papua, or to the Indonesians, they know it as Irian Jaya. That half of the island was part of the Dutch East Indies, but did not become part of the Republic of Indonesia in 1949. The Dutch actually retained the territory. And it wasn't until the early 1960s that there were movements to try and identify what needs to happen with that territory. The Sukarno government agreed that by the end of the decade, there would be a referendum to identify what the people of West Papua wanted.
Oh, the people of West Papua get a say in this matter. That's pretty exciting.
Not many, as it turned out. By 1969, they hadn't held this referendum. And so Suharto decided that the mechanism for that referendum, hitherto regarded as, quote, the act of free choice, was to round up 1,000 village leaders, put them in a room, and tell them when to raise their hand. Any dissension was not going to be looked upon favourably. So those 1,000 unanimously voted that West Papua become incorporated into the Republic of Indonesia. And Indonesia today still refers to that sham referendum as the justification.
Suharto remained popular in Indonesia while the economy was strong, but the wider Asian economic collapse in 1997 hit Indonesia's economy, which was on the brink of collapse. Suharto's failure to get to grips with the economic problems brought a wave of student protests, resulting in crackdowns and, of course, killing of protesters. Suharto failed to fix the economic crisis. One observer noted, "This is something he cannot shoot and something he cannot put in jail." The protests continued and degenerated into riots targeting ethnic Chinese minorities for no particular reason. The protests continued and Suharto resigned on the 18th of May 1998. After the fall of Suharto, pressure from Australia and Portugal forced an independent referendum in East Timor and they subsequently gained independence. Suharto was never prosecuted for his many crimes, although his son Tommy was jailed for murdering a judge. Suharto died in Jakarta in 2008.
So, Scott, if it's okay, I'd like to share with you what the New York Times wrote about Suharto after he died. Quote, "As the leader of one of the world's most populous countries, Suharto and his family became notorious for controlling state enterprises and taking kickbacks for government contracts, for siphoning money from state charities, and for committing gross violations of human rights." The New York Times obituary then went on to refer to a convulsion of mass bloodletting when he seized power in the late 1960s that took at least 500,000 lives.
Looking at these two dictators, they have a lot in common, don't they?
It's firstly the fact that they're such widespread archipelagos with so many different backgrounds. Both were colonised by Europeans in the 16th century. Both were invaded by the Japanese in 1942 and then obtained independence. Both countries faced communist insurgencies in the mid-1960s. And both Marcos and Suharto were able to, while repressing those communist insurgencies, were certainly able to turn them to their advantage in the sense that the communists became the respective Group X in those countries and were apparently responsible for all the ills of the country. So the commonalities between the two, quite strong, against that, we have to acknowledge that Suharto came from a military background, and despite his claims, Marcos didn't. They both stepped down from power and were able to die of natural causes, unlike a lot of the dictators that we've met. Both of them were charged for their crimes, but neither got to face trial.
So we have to choose a winner, not to diminish anything that Marcos did, but the 500,000 to a million dead in Indonesia, I think Suharto wins biggest, baddest, meanest on that front. Another characteristic that we look at is historical significance.
That's a biggie. If we look at the subsequent history of the two countries, the Philippines appears to have been less stable, whereas Indonesia has had continued presidential elections. It's no longer a one-party state, and there've been peaceful transitions of power from one president to the next. Who left their country in a bigger mess? I would say Marcos. I think Suharto left Indonesia in better shape than Marcos did in the Philippines. Under which regime would I have preferred to live? That's a tough one. If you weren't a communist or declared to be a communist, I think I'd have probably felt safer in Indonesia than in the Philippines. I think I hate Marcos more than I hate Suharto.
Really?
Yeah, I think I do. Now, that might be the wife factor.
See, I like Imelda. I'm choosing to live in the Philippines just to see her. Just so maybe I can bump into her. Cartier tiara. It'd be fantastic. Ask her which pair of shoes she's wearing.
Yeah, what was wrong with the other 1,060 pairs of shoes that she's not wearing that day?
Maybe I can bring her some cheese. She's very fond of cheese.
She's extremely fond of cheese. Even though I think Suharto left Indonesia in better shape than Marcos did the Philippines, I think we've probably got to look at the whole repression of the Suharto regime to look at him being the more likely winner out of these two. Certainly, Suharto was biggest, baddest, meanest.
Yeah, I think I have to go for Suharto. The numbers too big. And then also, in terms of the embezzlement, if we're going to have a contest, we have to bring up the fact that as good a job as the Marcos family did, $10 billion, Suharto managed $35 billion.
It is close, and I think you're right. I think Suharto is the one who goes forward. The irony is that when she listens to the podcast, Imelda will probably be disappointed.
She will. I'm sorry, Imelda. Suharto of Indonesia has made it through to the next round. Ferdinand Marcos is eliminated from the tournament. Congratulations to President Suharto.
Next time, Scott, we're going to North Africa.
North Africa, how good.
We're going to look at Libya and Egypt. So we'll be covering Mubarak and Gaddafi.
Oh, that's so good. The Arab Spring, all of the fantastically horrific things they got up to. Thank you, Uncle Ian.
Thank you, Scott.
See you next time in North Africa.